This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. More than 80% of Utah's diverted water is used for agriculture, but only a small portion of that is for growing vegetables. Most is used for alfalfa and pasture land. The Source's Ross Chambliss looked into how farmers are saving water by simply changing what they grow in an increasingly urban environment.
You have to look carefully, but there are still patches of farmland in Draper, one of the fastest growing urban spaces in Utah. Nestled between asphalt parking lots, the city library, an IFA store, and a senior center is one small acre of vegetable rows. Nearby, chickens are clucking, honeybees are buzzing, and this urban farmer is just stepping down from his mini tractor.
It's Marty Alston, and we own and run Urban Farm and Feed. And this year we've got about 15 acres on our hands that we take care of, mostly vegetables, a little bit of pasture land, and a few trees, fruit trees, not too many, but.
Alston says he grew up here, but he's not from a farming family. Still, it's something that he's always wanted to do. That's why 3 years ago, when this acre first came up for grabs, he says he and his wife bought this tractor and got to work.
This year we did one third of it as tomatoes. We have almost 1,500 tomato plants here. We did a lot of watermelon, cantaloupe, cucumbers, and eggplant here this year, mostly all summer crops.
Alston says they have a CSA program. They also sell their produce at farmers markets and at a store they operate, and they sell it wholesale to local buyers. Alston and his small crew can produce roughly 1,500 pounds of food on this one-acre plot each year, and they do that using an efficient pressurized drip irrigation system. He says he uses 142,000 gallons in a year.
Under this system, I water traditionally once a week for 24 hours, and that puts down about 3 to 4 inches of rainwater. One of the really nice things is that we're applying water directly to the plant because the drip tape runs right along the tops of the plants.
Looking at the big picture, roughly 80% of Utah's diverted water goes to agriculture. But few farmers like Alston are using that water to grow vegetables, and even fewer, maybe less than 1%, are using drip irrigation. Instead, more than half of Utah farmers resemble Alston's neighbor across the way, who still irrigates a pasture with a traditional wheel-line sprinkler.
The field that we can see right next to us is 8 acres of alfalfa, and you can see his old barn there in the background. That was the milk processing plant. They used to do a lot of dairy over there.
The neighbor's alfalfa crop likely consumes more than twice the amount of water per acre in a year that Alston needs for vegetables. And that number would be as much as 3 times the amount if the neighbor were flood irrigating, as many Utah farmers still practice to grow alfalfa for hay. The bulk of Utah's agriculture is indeed dedicated to alfalfa and pasture land. In 2010, just over 50% of irrigated cropland was used for alfalfa and grass hay. 30% is used for pasture land. Hay is, after all, a legume that can be grown and harvested 4 to 5 times a year. Utah's arid climate is seen as a good place to grow it, and it's a major feed ingredient for the dairy and beef industries. But studies estimate upwards of 2,000 gallons of water is needed to produce just 1 pound of beef.
It's a hard one to stab at because everyone loves their meat, but yes, absolutely. The lower you eat on the food chain, the less water involved by a significant amount. And, you know, we talked earlier about just flooding alone and the difference in watering. And so if we're saving 75% of our water directly by growing vegetables, and then we're saving, it just multiplies by so many levels. If you grow this 1 acre and use 4 times the amount of water, and then you give that hay to an animal, it's only going to provide, you know, enough hay for maybe three cows, and those cows drink water directly, and so on. So anyway, so it just compounds.
If you're in a desert and water's really precious, the last thing in the world you should be growing is hay, right? You should be growing high value crops that take a small amount of water.
This is Dan McCool, a professor of political science at the University of Utah.
First of all, if farmers were incentivized to use water more efficiently, we could solve the water problem without a dramatic or even a significant reduction in agriculture. But they're not incentivized. In fact, the incentives due to the prior appropriation doctrine are exactly the opposite. Any water they save, they lose.
McCool is referring to the use it or lose it stipulation under Utah's water rights policy. The law lets farmers who were, quote, first in time, first in right, to hang on to their water rights in perpetuity as long as they use it for, quote, beneficial use. Critics point out that even if farmers find ways to cut back their water use, state water laws don't reward them for conserving or making their irrigation more efficient. Other western states, like California, have tried to adopt more progressive water rights policies and water markets to address these issues. But McCool also says,
the other problem is that none of us eat hay. It's actually a very inefficient use of water, and it generates very little economic prosperity. Hay's a low-value crop.
Dan McCool's argument is that compared to, say, growing vegetables or corn or wheat, hay is inefficient because it gets a relatively small profit for farmers for the amount of work and water going into it. Still, it's hard to argue with economics and consumer demand for beef. It should be noted that over 70% of the income earned by most Utah farmers today comes from growing livestock forage, like alfalfa, and raising livestock.
All right, let's focus on the term efficient.
Oh, and then there's the concept of efficiency. This is Warren Peterson. He's a vice president of the Farmland Reserve, an affiliate of the Mormon Church that works to preserve farmland. He's also on Utah Governor Gary Herbert's water advisory team. He says water academics that have studied Utah's Sevier River Basin, where flooding fields for alfalfa is commonplace, is actually among the most efficient water systems in the West.
Some of it's converting to sprinkler irrigation, but the sprinklers are less efficient than the flood irrigation, because the water goes out into the ground, waters the crop, the portion that's not used by the crop sinks back into the soil, returns to the river channel, goes on down to the next water user, and some of those water molecules that make up the Sevier River, by the time they get to the farming systems at the end of the river, have been taken out of the river and found their way back in seven times over. So efficiency has to be defined in context of the river basin first, and then the on-farm use second.
Evaporation losses with sprinkler irrigation can be a concern for farmers in some cases. But the point Peterson is also making is that flood irrigation, while on its face seems wasteful and inefficient, can actually nourish stream vegetation and even function as makeshift wetlands for birds and other wildlife. That's something that doesn't happen with highly efficient irrigation systems. Still, at the end of the day, producing food, whether that's fruits and vegetables or forage for livestock, simply requires a lot of water. Certain laws of nature and biology just can't be changed, no matter how efficient we get. Still, Peterson agrees more should be done to help farmers be resourceful.
We're cutting back on basic research in the application of irrigated technology at the very time that our population growth and the fact that our water demand curve has crossed the supply curve in most areas. We have more demand for water than we have supply, and yet we're not putting money into basic agricultural research. I've met with researchers who say that in the right conditions, you can grow a head of lettuce with 1 gallon of water instead of 150 gallons of water. We really need to explore those things. We need to apply them in an urban setting. We need to get away from this notion that the average item on our plate travels more than 1,000 miles to get from the farm to the fork.
Utah farmers in general have made progress towards being more efficient, and numerous federal and state grants and revolving funds designed to incentivize smart water use are available to farmers and ranchers who normally couldn't afford costly improvements. Peterson argues that Utah has an agricultural legacy to protect.
We've taken the notion in Utah, because we've had a plentiful food supply, that it doesn't really hurt to convert ag land into parking lots and yards and public buildings and so on. And yet we have a growing population. Utah is a food net importer. So are we going to continue to use up our farmland and rely on some other people to send us the food? And I realize we're part of the great United States, and food is cheaper than it's ever been, but we need to think about this.
So the problem is not, you know, are we all going to starve to death?
Again, that's Dan McCool. He acknowledges that polls consistently show preservation of open spaces and farmland is important for most Utahns, but not necessarily food self-sufficiency. And he points out that in the past decade, a growing percentage of hay produced in the state and the precious water embedded in it is getting exported to cows in China.
If we want to be food efficient in Utah, again, the last thing in the world we'd want to be doing is exporting hay to Asia. That's why we have to import food. Now, importing food is not necessarily a bad thing. We can't grow everything here. You know, it makes more sense to grow rice in Louisiana. Right? I buy bananas. Doesn't make any sense to grow bananas here. We have to import those. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. Being self-dependent on food, when you're going to put 3 and then 6 million people in a desert state, just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Historically speaking, Utah farmers used irrigation to grow lots of varieties of fruits and vegetables, even as recently as 50 years ago. This is Neil Allen, an extension irrigation specialist with Utah State University.
I grew up here in northern Utah, and when I was young, we grew a lot of vegetable crops for Del Monte, and at one time, there was probably about 45 canneries here in Utah. And so they're gone now, and so we have a good climate for vegetables, but we just have a small market for vegetables, and that's primarily just the fresh produce market, with the exception of onions, which we do have a pretty significant amount of onions that are grown. And I think as those older canneries needed to be updated, there just wasn't the acreage and water resources to support new canneries, and so they've kind of moved to areas with larger acreage and where they can get more vegetables.
California and Florida produce the bulk of fresh fruits and vegetables for processing in the U.S. these days. Allen says the reason most vegetable processors left the state is that growing vegetables in dry places is risky from a farmer's perspective. They generally grow better in places with warmer, wetter climates, on land that can be irrigated regularly. Yet with improved technologies, use of greenhouses, and more efficient irrigation, Allen says even Utah's arid climate could one day produce many kinds of fruits and vegetables again. The more important question, perhaps, is whether open spaces usable for farming can sustain the state's growing population. Back in Draper City, here's Marty Alston.
I can tell you right now, the city wants this piece of ground we're standing on. For, they've placed the city library and the senior center right here, and just down the street is, you know, the city hall and everything, and they want what's in between, which is all this agricultural land. So, you know, being that we're really hopeful that being right here by the library and the people, they stop and talk to me every day. People just pull up and want to talk and are very interested about what we're doing and excited about it. And, you know, I hope that come the day where the city really wants to take it over, that there will be pushback from the community because they do want the farm here. And so I hope that there's some value to that. Because if there's not any value to it from the community, then it will get eaten up from the city, and it'll push farms out of the valley here.
Alston says for now he's optimistic. Farming is his passion, and while he's not fully able to make a living on it alone, he operates a construction equipment company on the side, he does cover his costs, and it's a growing operation. He's hiring more people, and he says he's already picked up 2 additional pieces of ground, 7 acres in West Valley City and another 4 acres in Sandy. where he plans to grow an even bigger urban harvest beginning next year. For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss. I'm gonna be round my vegetables, I'm gonna chop down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Residential lawns and gardens are not considered agriculture, but when many Utah towns were settled, there was no commercial farming and therefore no distinction. When The Source continues, we look at how leftover pioneer irrigation systems still in use in northern Utah muddy the waters between what's residential, what's agricultural, and what's a gift from God. Stay tuned. I know that you feel better when you send us in your letter and tell us the name of your favorite vegetable. Almost as soon as Cache Valley was settled by Mormon pioneers, water was diverted out of the Logan River. Rather than cluster themselves around the mouth of Logan Canyon where the river came out, they started digging ditches, and gravity fed the entire valley through a system of canals. In the 1850s, there was a drought in Utah, and the Salt Lake Valley was already getting crowded, with pioneers coming west from the States and from places in Europe. And the leader of the Mormon Church, Brigham Young, needed to spread out, and the native grasses of Cache Valley seemed promising for supporting a community of saints. From trappers who had worked in the valley but never settled, he knew that winters were harsh there, but the water seemed plentiful. It was a gamble, but he decided to send settlers in 1856. Joel Ricks was one of those early settlers. He moved his family to Cache Valley in 1859 when there were only about 150 families living there.
March 25th, 1860. Ezra T. Benson came to Logan to locate as president of this valley. The people turned out en masse and fenced in his city lot, and I dug him a well. March 27th, we commenced to dig the first water ditch along the foot of the hill, known as the Logan and Hyde Park Canal.
The first drop of water that moved out of the Logan River and into the Logan and Hyde Park Canal marked a permanent change to the landscape of Cache Valley. The settlers soon realized that they could move water almost anywhere they wanted it. The canals were dug by hand, or with ox teams pulling something they called a go-devil, a primitive plow made from two huge logs. Pioneer diaries from the late 1860s to even after the First World War are full of canal stories. Even the most tight-lipped, short-handed pioneer man mentions going to canal meetings or dealing with canal-related lawsuits or fixing a breach in the canal, in between his similarly brief mentions of an infant dying or a particularly annoying flare-up of hemorrhoids. The diary of James Sherlock Cantwell has this entry from 1915.
July 8. I am busy all the time trying to distribute the water on the canal. Everything needs water. The beets and potatoes all need water, and the supply in Logan River is going less all the time.
Fast forward 100 years to today, to this summer. Follow the Logan River through town, where it's siphoned off into what's called the Little Logan River, a canal technically, that runs under Main Street and right through the public high school. It feeds yards on the west side of town. It's a Wednesday morning, and water is running down the gutter on the side of 300 West in Logan, where Beth Shirley, who moved here from Boston last year, has a two-hour window to water her lawn.
So the grass was super green. It is not right now, but when I first bought the house, it was green because the people who were trying to sell the house had been using their rights every week pretty regularly to increase the value of the home. But then a couple weeks after I moved in, it started to get brown because I had no idea what I was supposed to be doing.
And how long have you lived in this house?
Just over a year. I bought it in July of 2014.
And did you know that you had water rights when you bought the house?
I did. I did not know what that meant, though.
So it wasn't a selling point?
No, not at all.
Hi.
of neighbors had come and introduced themselves, and this really sweet woman who lives just three houses north of me. I one day saw her husband out there messing with his water rights, and I just went up and asked if he would, if he could point me in the direction of the person to talk to. And instead, he just came and showed me how to use everything. He came over and showed me how this fancy pump thing works, and how to flood the yard by blocking off certain sections of the ditch, and yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Have you been pretty good about doing this every Wednesday?
Nope. I have used it once this year. This is the second time. The only reason I used it that one time was my parents were coming to town, and I was pretty embarrassed about how brown the yard was, so yeah, it's a real pain. It takes a good half hour to get it all set up, and then another half hour to take it all down. And I just, aesthetically, it doesn't bother me that the yard is brown. My block of time, I pull out these stopper. Oh, snake!
Well, he's not happy that you've just flooded his home.
Nope. Sorry, buddy. There's a little divot in my section of the ditch where it will flow as soon as I pull out this metal thing and the blocks that hold up the metal thing. Then the water, I block it from going underneath my driveway, and it redirects the water into the ditch that goes down the side of my yard, and it goes all the way into my backyard. And if I had a garden back there, that's where I would pull it out to irrigate.
And then you use this pump.
Yeah.
Which looks like a modified lawnmower?
It is a modified lawnmower. It came with the house. It did not come with instructions because somebody rigged it up themselves. It's pretty impressive when you think about it, that somebody came up with this idea. And if you look down the street, everybody has a completely different pump system that they're using. Like, no one else has a rigged up lawnmower. This is why I don't do this very often.
Okay.
Put that back on so it doesn't bubble over.
Handmade plug.
Yep. Right? It's someone went to a lot of trouble to make this. I have no idea how old it is. All right, and fingers crossed.
That's how it's done.
Yep.
Beth Shirley's house and small lot in Logan didn't come with instructions. This pump was sitting in her backyard when she bought the house. It really does look like a lawnmower, but it's this wonderful aquamarine blue color that they used to paint machinery with in the 50s. And it has some long plastic tubes coming out of it, so it's clearly not a lawnmower. Beth had to be told and shown by someone in the neighborhood, someone who'd lived there a really long time, how to water her lawn using the ditch water. This experience isn't unique to Beth. There aren't handbooks for using this irrigation system. Each canal is different. Each yard is different. You're just kind of expected to know what to do. But over time, this knowledge amasses into a collective understanding, and a culture emerges.
I think the first exposure I had to some of the folk rules about canal use and water usage was from my neighbor, William Skidmore, down in Logan.
Randy Williams is a folklorist and oral history specialist with the Utah State University Special Collections and Archives.
He taught me the rules of how to take my turn, from small things like turning on and opening up the gate and using the water in an appropriate way and damming up. So that was a rule for that neighborhood, and he taught me how to do that appropriately. And there was a definite consequence if you didn't do it appropriately. You flooded somebody's yard or their home, worse.
I love the phrase folk rules that Randy Williams uses. This encompasses all that you just know how to do it kind of knowledge, all these unspoken things that no one even writes down.
Well, I think folk rules just basically described are, or defined are, those rules that we learn in small groups, folk groups. And there's rules in our neighborhood, and you go to another neighborhood, and they have a little tweak on those rules for kick the can. with water, you mostly learn the rules of the irrigation company that you are on or with through your neighbors. Sometimes it's just somebody walking through, you know, from the canal company or from your canal community, giving information about what's happening, or they tell somebody in your neighborhood and then that person communicates it to you, kind of like a phone tree, but usually, a lot of times it's in person. Somebody goes door to door and explains it and then leaves the responsibility to somebody else in the neighborhood to tell other people, and it works its way through. A lot of those rules are folk created and manipulated to work. But more so than that, I think those folk rules that with water or anything else is the beauty of cooperation, the beauty of neighborhoods, the beauty of folk groups. I've learned a lot from my, you know, canal board and from my neighbors about how to be a good water user by, you know, those folk rules. I've never seen a handbook.
Randy Williams says that this whole process connects us to something much older and bigger than ourselves. That every time you get your hands dirty or pull up a rusty gate out of the gutter and watch the water flow into your little hand-dug ditch, or fiddle with an old pump someone made before you were born, you're connecting to a logic and a system that's bigger than you. This is the folklore of the West.
I think the whole idea of the water system in the West is ingenious, and I have benefited from it my whole life. My great-grandfather had water that came out of a dam, and as a child, I recognized what he was doing, but I wasn't involved. But then as an adult, having the opportunity to open up the gate and bring it down into my yard and making sure I had the rows prepared and my little dams or my rocks or what have you. And I have had moments in my own life realizing that I am like my great-grandfather. And my great-grandfather inherited a system that he didn't create and a logic he didn't create, but we were the beneficiaries of that logic, and we bring it forward. We are connecting back to our pioneer ancestors, who are then connecting back to people beyond and before them that gave them that logic to do something with the water. So I think when we're working those irrigation ditches, we are hearkening back to something.
Beth Shirley is definitely not into connecting to any pioneer ancestors.
I'd really like to xeriscape my front yard, and then I don't have to do the pump at all.
But Sean Hasboon, another non-native resident of Logan, has fully embraced the irrigation system in her backyard. She took me on a tour of her huge vegetable garden.
Okay, so while you can see, the way that we have our garden set up is that the ditch water comes through on the back end, and then there's little mini dishes down each row of vegetables. And we can control the flow by putting some rocks or dirt or sandbags at the head of the row.
And you dug all of these little ditches?
I did, because we plow it every year. It was quite the process.
Do you know how many there are?
There are 27. So the garden is 90 feet long by 33 feet wide. And there are 27 rows.
And would you call this a hobbyist garden?
I think we could have a small farmer's market out of here.
What are you growing?
I would call it a large hobbyist garden. Well, here's our squash. We have summer squash and winter squash, all varieties. We have a ton of tomatoes. You can see in those upright trellises. We have two rows of peppers. You can see our melons are doing well this year. There's some leeks and some dahlias, just because they're pretty. And then you can't really see beyond the wall of tomato.
Sean has access to her water share on Friday nights at 7 p.m. The journey starts in her backyard.
This is where we leave the property and get to walk on other people's property. And we kind of have to clear the ditch along the way. I brought a hoe and a rake because when the water runs through the ditch, it collects a lot of grass and sticks, piles them up. So I just kind of, you know, if I see anything really egregious or obstructive, I get it out of there. We've passed two gates, we're gonna pass a few more. All right, so we gotta wind around here.
I had no idea. I thought we would walk like to the end of your property.
No. This is our gate right here.
But there's no water.
No, we're gonna go. We have to go open the water at the road. All right. Gate number four, open, check. Gate number five, not very open. Now it's open. Alright. So now we actually get to see the water.
So we walked more than a block.
Oh yeah, we walked.
All right. There's water.
This is the water.
And it's running down the street.
Yes. So, first things first is opening our gate. And putting in the blocker.
The blocker prevents the water from going down the street and diverts it into Sean's ditch, which really is just that. It's dirt. It's not a concrete-lined canal or anything, if that's what you were picturing. It takes the water nearly an hour to get from the street back to the garden, where it slowly fills in each row. Sean says that she usually goes and makes dinner while she waits. Sean learned the folk rules of watering her garden from her husband, who lived here for a few years before they were married. He learned from a roommate when he moved in, and that roommate learned from the guy who lived there before him. There's this whole little folk logic to just this one yard, and it's generations of grad students who have passed through for 4 years at a time. Sean loves being a part of it.
Is this process enjoyable?
I actually really like it. I think the whole thing is rare, and it's a really satisfying way to water, even though it's really inefficient.
The inefficiency that Sean's talking about is a whole other story. Water managers in northern Utah have the unique challenge of trying to preserve this historic irrigation system that so many residents are in love with, on the one hand, with the realities of an aging infrastructure and an uncertain water future on the other. Luckily, I found someone who studies water managers and how they're dealing with this challenge ahead of them.
I'm Andrea Armstrong. I'm an assistant professor at Lafayette College, and I study irrigation organizations and how they manage water. I came to Utah State University to get my doctorate in sociology, and I found the irrigation groups here to be so fascinating, I wanted to devote my attention to them over the 4 years I was here. I had my eye out when I moved to Utah for small streams and gullies and things that I was used to seeing on the East Coast landscape, and in July and August, they're just not here. But what I did find was water running down my curb and gutter in the middle of a July afternoon, and thought, this is pretty cool. Something's going on here. So with that in mind, I've developed my interest in these little water systems and thinking about how all these little ditches that we see throughout Cache County and how they relate to the bigger water picture. So in Cache County, we have over 100 irrigation companies or irrigation organizations, and they each have water rights that they then control water and distribute it to their water users. It's a pretty unique system in that these irrigation groups can structure the timing and the mechanism through which water is delivered to someone's house, but then it's hands off, and once someone has that water, they have the ability to use it on their landscape, in their gardens, whatever way they see fit. The main objective of the irrigation group is to get water to their shareholders, to their users. And so managing water means anything from pulling the diversion gate on the Logan River to making sure that the ditches are clean so that their water users can receive their shares. The infrastructure that's used to convey water now is not far afield from what it was originally. Originally, these were earthen ditches dug by oxen with special plows behind them to make the ditches line at the right grade so that water would flow without pumping or too much encouragement. And now the canal systems are built largely on those original designs, but some have made improvements such as canal linings or in some cases even piping to increase the efficiency of the water that would be delivered to water users.
The first thing that I thought of actually when I saw water running down the side of the road was evaporation. Where is this water going? How much of it is getting lost before it reaches the place that it's going to? I mean, is this an efficient system?
The key with thinking about efficiency is efficiency for who or efficiency for what. And open canals or canals with earthen bottoms tend to lose quite a bit of water. So I've heard estimates of a 20% loss to evaporation, and some canals can lose up to 60% over the entire length of the canal, especially if that canal doesn't have a lined bottom. It might just be earth and rocks, and so a lot of the water then is lost to shallow groundwater. In a closed canal system where irrigation water is being moved through buried pipes or even pipes above ground, the losses to evaporation and seepage are much, much lower. There are some risks to pipes breaking, and the cost of piping canals is incredibly high, especially for some irrigation companies that don't necessarily have the cash reserves to just go out and put that new infrastructure in. But a major savings for them is that they will have a very known quantity of water that they are delivering to their water users, and they don't have to question how much would be lost on a given day under certain temperatures or with soil moisture being at a certain level. Now, with piping an irrigation system, we start to lose some of the benefits that a lot of Cache Valley residents have come accustomed to with our open canals. Things like willow trees growing nearby the canal or having ducks in your neighborhood. These are uncommon to the arid Utah landscape, but we have them in Cache Valley and in Logan because these open canals create a surface water system that's heavily, heavily managed by irrigation interests, but also benefit people that don't have irrigation shares. And so by closing some of these systems, we would lose the ability to A, see the water, which is, I think, very important. If you can see the water, you know where water's coming from. You know that it's part of your life and part of your neighborhood. But also you lose the ecosystems and the landscape features that are dependent upon open irrigation canals.
Andrea Armstrong is starting a new job at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. I asked her what she's going to miss about Cache Valley, both as a researcher and a resident.
This is such a unique irrigation system worldwide. I've been reading a bit more of the book Cadillac Desert lately, and this is a famous book on water management in the West. And the author, Mark Reisner, points out to the Mormon pioneers as being very, very foundational in their irrigation technology, that a lot of bigger irrigation systems in the West have been based on some of the early Mormon irrigation infrastructure. I see the landscape of Logan is so unique compared to even other places in the West that haven't had this interconnection between agriculture, water management, and the urban settlements that are nestled amongst all of it. When I think about the water features that I've grown attached to or accustomed to seeing in my daily life, humans are so connected to those water features. We put them there, we decide how much water flows through canals, how much water passes through these small ditches that run through my neighborhood. And so in thinking about the future of those small systems, I'd like to think that it's up to us as residents of Cache Valley to shape their future, to decide which ones of those we keep, or which ones we're willing to sacrifice for more efficient water delivery systems. I'll miss thinking about how these canals are the way they are because we've made them that way. And I'd like to hope that they will continue to be something that we want them to be, which is more than just getting water from point A to point B. It's become part of the landscape and the local culture.
I don't know if you've noticed, but everyone I talked to for this story used words like rare, unique, or special to describe the irrigation canals in Cache Valley. And even those who think that the canals are antiquated or even dangerous relics from the past in need of serious upgrading can probably agree that they are at least unique. and whether people feel connected to the water through their pioneer roots or because they grew up building Huckleberry Finn-style rafts and rope swings on the canal in their backyard, or just because they like the giant cottonwood trees that grow in what would otherwise be a sagebrush flat, everyone can probably settle on its specialness. The famous American historian Frederick Jackson Turner visited Logan from Harvard in the summer of 1924. He wrote to his wife,
"I walked in the moonlight in this wonderful mountain-walled valley last night and marveled. The song of running irrigation rivulets, the smell of the lush green meadows, the miles of concrete walks, bridges, and aqueducts, everything trim and garnished."
I'm sorry, but I'm not ready to let the canal thing go just yet. Everyone I talked to about the irrigation system in Cache Valley seemed to be dancing around something. When they talk about community or culture or folklore, they mean Mormon, don't they?
Yeah, it's wicked Mormon.
I mean, you've got the streets,
the poplar trees, and the ditches. And, you know, Frank Avila, whoever wrote that book, said if you drop someone from Mars and they saw the streets, the trees, and the ditches, they would know they were in Utah.
Then I found Catherine Morse, a professor of history and environmental studies at Middlebury College in Vermont. She wrote a paper called Nature's Second Course, Water Culture in the Mormon Communities of Cache Valley, Utah, 1860 to 1916. So I knew we would probably get along just fine. I called her up. So how does a professor in Vermont know so much about Logan Canals?
In 1988, just after I graduated from college, I enrolled at Utah State University in the master's degree program in history. And between 1988 and 1990, I lived in Logan and researched my master's thesis on the history of the Logan River irrigation system in Cache Valley.
It's not just about the history itself. I mean, you begin with the symbolism of water. What specifically? I mean, water symbolizes a whole lot.
It does. It can symbolize almost anything you want it to symbolize.
Right. So specifically, the early Mormon pioneers, were there specific symbols that water represented for them?
Well, in the study, I ended up finding a bunch of different powerful symbolic meanings. One of which is a basic agrarian belief that's central to all of American culture, and pioneer Mormon culture was sort of a profound distillation of elements of American culture, which is the commandment of a higher power or of God to create an agricultural paradise or Eden in the uncivilized world of the American West. And, you know, millions of different Anglo-Americans did that, but Mormons did it with particular focus and energy. And in that agrarianism, the idea of creating a green Eden in a desert, in that sort of biblical sense, led them to apply themselves with great energy to bringing water to the land, to bringing baptismal forces of life to the replenishment of what seemed like a desert, a lost or fallen place that needed to be restored to an Edenic state. That's why they call irrigation reclamation, because it reclaims a fallen world into a paradise.
Speaking of the non-separation of church and state, water rights in Utah, and it's not specific to Utah, but it was articulated very well in Utah. We always talk about this beneficial use condition, so that you can have the water and it is yours to be a steward of, but
yes,
you have to prove that you are using it beneficially. In your paper, you say that early on that beneficial use meant beneficial in the eyes of the church.
What's so fascinating is it's almost impossible to separate the religious mission of the community from the use of water, because everyone initially in those very early decades was by and large Mormon, and therefore the beneficial use to create homes, to irrigate crops, to feed livestock, to raise families, was part of the mission of the religious group itself. So it's really hard to find a place in which those two missions, to create an agricultural community of saints, was separate from the beneficial use of water.
So a lot of the canals are still uncovered. They were uncovered then, and they are uncovered now. Was it important to the pioneers to have them uncovered for sort of practical reasons or more symbolic reasons? I mean, why is the water still kind of on display?
Well, I certainly wrote in the paper that the ostentatious display of water is part of the sort of pride and declaration that nature has been subdued to create a vibrant, successful community, that in a desert a community could achieve such mastery of water as to control it so beautifully and channel it so fruitfully into a green and verdant village landscape. It definitely seems, if not ostentatious, then pride in the control of nature for higher purposes. But I imagine it started because that was the cheapest way to do it, that running water along the surface in dirt canals was fast, was quick, and was easy to create. And then being able to eyeball the supply meant that you could distribute it relatively quickly and easily. All you had to do to figure out how much water was in the ditch was look in the ditch. So leaks are easily identified and fixed. Floods are easy to see coming, and damage is relatively quick to find and repair. Wouldn't be the case if these were pipelines buried or aqueducts that could be damaged. So it probably was a combination of cultural value and low capital investment at the start.
In the second case, not much has changed.
The Central Arizona Project, I mean, it's a late 20th century engineering marvel, and it's still piping water uncovered across the hottest desert in the nation.
Right.
Yeah, so it seems to be an American thing to keep the water visible from the surface.
You probably haven't been to City Creek Mall yet in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, I was there in the late 90s. I haven't been into any of the new malls.
Yeah, they basically built a mall around what used to be City Creek and turned City Creek into a Las Vegas-style artificial
waterway. A water feature.
A feature, yes.
Yeah.
Did you have a water share when you lived in Logan? Did you have any experience with using the
ditch? I was in rental apartments that were up near the university that weren't fully served that way. But mostly I would just ride my bike and look and watch how the water was moving and sort of get curious about where it came out of various ditches and how it crossed streets. So I didn't have the personal experience of opening and closing the gates. But I would bike the canal routes up north towards Hyde Park and see where they went. And it was beautiful. I mean, it's a very beautiful landscape in many ways.
Do you teach about the Mormon irrigation system? Do you teach water in the West or anything like that in Vermont?
Not in great detail, but yes, I teach a history of the American West and an environmental history, and I certainly used the information about Logan and showed students the map and the way the village grid is so beautifully imposed on the canyon landscapes at these specific points along the Wasatch Front, and how that was a clear adaptation to both aridity and abundance in those places along the valley. And, of course, New England, many Mormons did come from upstate New York and New England, so there are similarities. I live in an agricultural valley dominated by dairy farms. There are towns named Mendon and Hyde Park. There are similarities. So there are ways to talk about how agrarian values and agrarian landscapes appear in different forms across the country.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been so interesting.
All right, and say hi to the ditches for me.
I will do.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The source comes from the studios of Utah Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. I produce this here program, and I'm grateful for financial support from iUtah. My obsessive canal story was wonderfully produced by Ryan Cunningham. James Singer was the voice of the pioneers in that story. I got a lot of help and a lot of irrigation documents I couldn't make sense of from Bob Parson at the USU Special Collection and Archives. Thank you, Ross Chambliss, for always finding water stories with me. Thank you, Megan Simper, for writing our theme song that I will never tire of. And thank you for listening. Let's do it again at the end of next month.